designing the next moon suits and controversy over land for SpaceX. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. As NASA prepares humans to land back on the moon for the first time in decades, the crew is going to need a new spacesuit.
Ultimately, the suit we have today is kind of a revolutionary new spacesuit.
Axiom Space is tasked with that order. We'll speak with the company's Russell Ralston about the new suit and the tech that goes with it. Then we head to Starbase in Texas, where there's growing controversy over a land deal involving SpaceX and the U.S. government. And one of the concerns is for local wildlife.
If SpaceX takes over part of this core part of this one national wildlife refuge that supports an ocelot population, it's going to degrade that habitat.
SpaceX.com's Mike Wall is covering that story and brings us up to speed on what's happening at the manufacturing and launch site of SpaceX's Starship rocket. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? NASA's plans for Artemis IV include sending humans to the moon, where they'll walk on the surface for the first time since the Apollo missions. There's much work to be done before NASA can make that 2028 deadline. It needs a spacecraft to bring the astronauts to the surface. The agency is testing two of those as early as next year. It will also need new spacesuits. That's a job for Axiom Space. The commercial space company is designing and building its extravehicular mobility unit for the crew, called the AXEMU. It's equipped with protection to withstand the moon's harsh environment, keeping the crew safe, allowing them to work, and also keeping them looking fresh. Here to talk more about this new spacesuit and the design process is Russell Ralston, the Vice President of Spacecraft Development for Axiom Space. Russell, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's great to chat with you. You know, as Axiom Space develops this new spacesuit for Artemis astronauts, can you just tell me how high are these stakes when it comes to making this actually happen?
It's hard to imagine them being higher. It's certainly an honor and a privilege to be able to do this. It's very exciting, something that we're glad to be a part of, but it is fundamentally a very serious endeavor.
When Axiom Space was awarded this contract to build these spacesuits, what were the parameters from NASA? What were you tasked with building?
There's a number of requirements that I can speak to, but more broadly than that, maybe I'll start here. The contract, the XEVS contract, is fundamentally a service contract. So we're building spacesuits to provide an EVA service, but it's not just the spacesuits. We're also, you know, the spacesuit gets most of the attention, but there's a lot of other equipment that goes with it. There's flight support equipment, things like battery chargers that charge the batteries that the suit uses, and umbilicals that help us refuel some of the consumables on board, things like that. There's also EVA tools. So as part of the system, we're providing a lot of the tools that the astronauts will use to perform scientific or geology tasks and things like that on the moon. So it's really the whole suite of and system of things that the astronauts need to conduct EVAs during their mission.
Did NASA come with you and say, here's a list of all the things we need? Or did they come with you and say, here's what we're going to do, come up with all the stuff we're going to need for that?
A little bit of both. So there were definitely some specifics in terms of we want this and this and this. But there was some flexibility to creatively approach some of those solutions. In some cases, they specified high level objectives and then said, okay, tell us how you can help us meet this objective. So it was a little bit of both.
Are you building this from the ground up or from scratch, or are you relying on some historical suit designs and engineering plans that we humans have been using over the past five decades of space exploration?
At a high level, I would also say that the answer is both. So in some cases, if we look at certain parts of the spacesuit, because the spacesuit, you know, is comprised of many different components, elements. Some of those are brand new that we've just created. Many of them, though, and probably the majority, were ones that in the former campaign to develop a new spacesuit was a project called the XEMU project at NASA. I actually worked there at the time on that project, and we leveraged a lot of the good data that came out of that particular project so that we didn't start from scratch, because there was a lot of time, effort, and taxpayer dollars spent on that effort. And we felt like the wise thing to do was to leverage that prior investment, learn from it. And really what I would say is that comprehensively we've refined that architecture, combined it with some new things that we've innovated. And ultimately the suit we have today is kind of a a revolutionary new spacesuit. I mean, it leverages lessons learned from the past from other suits, Apollo, EMU, things like that. But it's very different in many ways.
I do want to talk about those differences, but before we get to that, I want to talk about the challenges that you're faced with when it comes to designing this, right? I mean, on the International Space Station, astronauts use extravehicular suits quite often to do spacewalks. There are particular challenges when it comes to that, but on the surface of the moon has got to be an even harsher environment than low Earth orbit and the International Space Station, right? Tell me what you're up against.
It is. No, you're exactly right. And the other thing is that not only is it the surface of the moon, but the plan is to go to the South Pole currently, which is one of the more challenging environments.
It's cold, right? Cold and dark.
Well, it's cold. It's simultaneously cold and hot. A lot of people don't know this, but all the Apollo missions were equatorial. So when they flew to the moon, they flew roughly, to the equator of the moon. And they were in the sun basically the entire time. So all they had to deal with, I say all, it was still quite a challenge, but they had to deal with mainly heat in terms of things heating up. At the South Pole, if you find yourself in the sun, in the sunlight, yeah, you're gonna get hot. There's no atmosphere, so that heat comes directly from the light from the sun coming off of the, coming off the sun. However, if you're in the shadow, you have to deal with cold, and you can deal with very extreme hot and cold temperatures simultaneously if you're standing in a, where the shadow passes. So not only are the temperatures extreme, the dust is a challenge. Rocks on the moon are very sharp. It's rocks on Earth, a lot of them, unless they've been like freshly broken or something, they're typically rounded, right? If you think of like pebbles in a stream or something like that, well, that's because of erosion over time. On the moon, you don't have that. So everything's very sharp. Now I have an inflatable suit and I'm walking out amongst very sharp rocks. So that's a challenge that we have to solve. And then just in addition to the fact that it's a fundamentally uninhabitable environment, there's vacuum, there's no atmosphere. It's a challenge. It's a hard problem to solve for sure.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Axiom Space's Russell Ralston. He's the Vice President of Spacecraft Development. We're talking about the development of the AXEMU suit to be used by Artemis astronauts. Russell, you talked about all the challenges you're up against. How did you overcome those challenges? What were some of the designs that you had to do to, be able to work in this hostile environment with, dirt that's trying to get into your suit?
I mean, first and foremost, it starts with an incredible team. I mean, we have an incredible team of engineers here that are super smart, that we have a lot of experience in spacesuit design and development from the team. I think our company might be newer to individuals, but our team is composed of people that have been doing spacesuits for a very long time. We've had to innovate many things. The designs of certain joints in our suit to prevent dust from getting inside of those and basically grinding up the joint for mobility. We have had to innovate new fabrics. We've talked publicly about our partnership with Prada and some of the things that we've done there in terms of looking at new materials, both in and outside the suit to help improve and enhance performance in terms of durability and protection from dust and just overall astronaut comfort, things like that. We've also taken a look at all the mobility for the suit itself and what is the right kind of optimization of the different mobility elements and joints that we have. So in a number of different areas, I think we've done a lot of work to make sure that this suit is going to be the most capable that's ever flown.
Russell, this is a subjective observation, but the suit looks cool. How important is it looks when it comes to this?
I happen to agree. I actually think it looks fantastic. And I have to thank Prada for their help in that. That was one of the first things we worked on together was the aesthetic of the suit. And, it's easy. I love this question because it's really easy in our world to just, you're solving such a difficult problem to let the engineering really overpower everything else. But my observation is that the spacesuit is iconic and people really resonate with it. And so we felt like, this is the first time a new suit's will be flown in almost 50 years. And so it's going to inspire a whole new generation of people. And it needs to be something that people can connect with and relate with. And while the engineering is unquestionably impressive, I mean, we have some of the best engineers in the world here. That connection to the broader public was incredibly important for us.
And seeing what happened with Artemis II and just the public attention, I mean, now we're even adding to the stakes even higher, right?
I'm certain that for the first landing, when these suits fly for the first time on the International Space Station, there's going to be quite a bit of attention on it. And we're excited about that and working very hard to make sure that first and foremost, above everything, we keep the crew safe. But that after that, you know, it's a high performing suit. It looks good. It connects with people. So yeah, a lot of good work has gone into that.
Russell, before you get to that moment where astronauts step foot on the lunar surface in those suits, there is an OIG report from NASA that found that there were concerns with the timeline of this program and that it may not be ready. What is the company's response to that? What still needs to be done? And you know, are you ready for Artemis 4?
Yeah, so we're certainly ready and we're excited, like I said, to be a part of it. You know, I thought that OIG report was actually a really good one. In my career, I've seen a lot of those and I thought it was pretty good. I think it accurately pointed out some of the technical and programmatic challenges. You know, that to be clear, that report was an investigation on NASA's management of the contract. That's the role that the OIG has. But obviously, we're inherently linked into that because of our performance on the contract. And I think they did a really good job. And I think that our team and NASA, we've worked really well together to address those challenges. That report actually came out, it was a little over a year after we worked that. And by the time it came out, we had already fixed a lot of the things that come up. But yeah, we remain on track to fly in the suit for the first time next year to the International Space Station. And then shortly thereafter on Artemis 4, we're building our qualification suit right now. So it's actively being assembled, like literally as we speak. And so we're going to keep pushing hard on that, get that ready for testing this year, and then looking forward to flying it next year.
And we should add that NASA Minister Jared Isaacman wrote after that report came out, quote, "I'm confident that when NASA is ready to land on the moon in 2028, our astronauts will be wearing Axiom suits." So confidence in your work there. Finally, Russell, you know, you are working on a spacesuit for the next astronauts that are going to land on the moon for the first time in more than 50 years. Personally, what is it like to be a part of this process?
You feel a lot of things, excited. It's a very rare opportunity, and you don't want to take it for granted. And, you know, I have the blessing of being able to give a lot of tours to different people, different groups of people. And it's always fun to give a tour and to show off the work we're doing, to show the suits, and to answer questions when people see them, because it's kind of a reminder fairly frequently of just what a privilege it is to be doing this and to work on this project. And then to watch all of the hard work of the team come to fruition it's a real privilege. So I try to just kind of take it one day at a time and not take it for granted. I tell the team sometimes that these are the good old days. So we'll look back and go, oh man, that was it right there. So it's pretty special.
Have you put the suit on, Russell?
I have. Yeah. So in my former days, I was a spacesuit test subject at NASA, actually, before I worked at Axiom. And I have gotten an R suit. And obviously, anytime you get in the suit, it's fun. So
spacesuit test subject. That's a dream job right there. Huh?
It wasn't my only responsibility, but it was a part of it. And it was pretty fun. I can't lie.
Sounds good, Russell. We'll be following along. Russell, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Super happy to be here. Thank you.
That was Russell Ralston, the Vice President of Spacecraft Development for Axiom Space. Still to come, as SpaceX expands, groups push back with legal action.
Wetlands are critical habitat for a lot of shorebirds and a lot of aquatic life. And there's about 700 acres that SpaceX wanted that was kind of closer to its main starbase operations. And they were approved a swap of that land to SpaceX from one National Wildlife Refuge that kind of abuts starbase.
We'll look at the controversy surrounding a potential land deal for SpaceX. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. In Texas, SpaceX wants to trade with the U.S. for land, specifically 715 acres near Starbase, the company's manufacturing and launch facility for its giant rocket Starship. It would give back 683 acres to the U.S. But groups say that the swap would violate multiple laws and threaten the local environment. Here to talk more about the swap, the lawsuit, and a recently filed injunction is Mike Wall, the channel editor for Space Flight and Tech at space.com, who has been following the story. Mike, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Hi, good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. We're going to talk about some of your recent reporting here. This involves a land swap. First of all, can you just tell us what is this land and why is SpaceX interested in it?
This land is basically close to Starbase, which is this burgeoning kind of city that SpaceX has been building in far southern Texas, down by the Mexico border, kind of near Brownsville. And it's like the manufacturing and launch hub for their giant new fully reusable rocket called Starship. It's the biggest and most powerful rocket ever built. It's like 400 feet tall. And SpaceX really views it as the future of the company, the future of spaceflight, something like so transformative it could help us get colonies on Mars and all sorts of crazy stuff that we've only dreamed about doing since the space age dawned.
And tell me a bit about the land. How much are we talking here?
What's interesting about, well, there are a lot of interesting things about Starbase, but it's in a beautiful spot. If people have seen any of the sort of video of the Starship test launches to date, there have been 13 of them. You can see the rocket rising from the seaside pad, and like all around it are these wetlands. It's like really beautiful, and it's like very ecologically diverse too. You know, wetlands are critical habitat for a lot of shorebirds and a lot of aquatic life. And there's about 700 acres that SpaceX wanted that was kind of closer to its main Starbase operations, and they were approved a swap of their, it's actually 715 acres. They were approved the swap of that land to SpaceX from one National Wildlife Refuge that kind of abuts Starbase. And in like return, they're giving the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service 683 acres that's sort of scattered over a few different locations, but that will be given to the wildlife refuge near Starbase and to a different National Wildlife Refuge that's just sort of catty corner to it, or that's right next door to it. So it's almost like a one-to-one swap in terms of the territory, in terms of how like much land there is. But but they're in kind of different parts of this kind of wetland ecosystem that's in far southern Texas.
Is that where the conflict and controversy comes from? Is that they're swapping one for another and then one won't have protections if SpaceX has control of it?
Well, I think that the controversy, it's sort of, there are a couple things that the people who have filed this suit are objecting to. And one is that that like due diligence wasn't really like adhered to, that there are a few kind of laws that are being skirted is the allegation from like the assorted plaintiffs in this case. And that like one of them is like National Historic Preservation Act, I believe, because on the like parcel that SpaceX is going to get from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has this old like kind of Civil War battle site. I guess it was like the last battle fought in the Civil War. And so that like the land that that's on, which was part of the wildlife refuge, is going to SpaceX. And like the plaintiffs say, you know, it wasn't properly vetted under this act, that's like designed to help preserve historic landmarks. There are a few other, they have a few other objections too, that the land that SpaceX is going to take advantage or to take control of will be degraded and hasn't been properly vetted. It's biodiverse, and in this area of southern Texas is really interesting. It's one of the few places, is just southern Texas and southern Arizona is like the only two spots in the U.S. where like the ocelot actually lives. You know, like you think of it as like a little jungle cat, right? But it actually comes up into the southern U.S. in two spots, and like one of them is near Starbase, and there are ocelots who actually live there. It's a small population, but in the U.S. they're in danger. There aren't very many of them. So part of the lawsuit kind of says, you know, if SpaceX takes over part of this core part of this one National Wildlife Refuge that supports an ocelot population, it's going to degrade that habitat. And there are other things that they cite too about how you know, Starbase operations and these Starship launches are bad for sort of shorebirds, and they're endangered shorebirds in the area. So there are a couple of objections that they make that are kind of laid out in this lawsuit.
You may not know the answer to this because SpaceX is quite secretive, and you know, it's not a government agency. But do we know what they want to do with this land?
I assume that they want, it's sort of like, it's right in the core part of Starbase. It's sort of right next to their main Starbase operation. So I assume they want to expand Starbase. They have big plans for Starbase. I mean, it's actually, it started off as like a manufacturing center, and but it was recently incorporated as a city. It's like an actual city with this, has a mayor and all this stuff. So I assume that they just want to keep building it out, like along the main core part of Starbase. And that means building a lot of kind of residential areas for SpaceX workers, probably, and like more industrial buildings, because they have huge plans for Starship. You know, they want to be launching this thing just like thousands of times per year, which means a ton of manufacturing, kind of like a huge manufacturing footprint down there. And that's just going to require a lot of support kind of staff and buildings and infrastructure. So I assume that's what they envision for the area, but that's just an assumption. Like, as you said, you know, SpaceX does not talk very much to reporters. We often will email them for a comment on a story, and it's like, it's very rare to get any response. So you just kind of have to assume that that's what they're planning to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Glad it's not just me, Mike. Appreciate that.
Nope, it is not just you.
You're listening to Are We There Yet, the radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Mike Wall, channel editor for Space Flight and Tech at space.com, about his recent reporting over a dispute of a land swap related to property near SpaceX's Starbase. Mike, you are very well aware that this is not the only time SpaceX being down there in Texas has been controversial or with dispute. What is SpaceX saying about this recent challenge, and how might they've reacted in the past to things like this inform how they might move forward with this?
Pretty much what we've learned about this lawsuit is from stuff that the plaintiffs have put out, you know, press releases and so on from the plaintiffs. So I haven't seen anything from SpaceX that is more than just, we followed all the laws. You know, this agreement was signed with the U.S. government agency, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and everything is above board. We did everything that they asked. And so they would stress, I'm sure, that this is a lawful agreement and it was signed, like all the due diligence was done. They did all of the stuff they were supposed to do about kind of like environmental assessments and stuff like that. And that was signed off on by the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is the institution that runs these national wildlife refuges. So SpaceX would doubtless say that it's all above board and that we did everything that was asked of us. What's gonna be a question, I guess, if this lawsuit continues to move forward. I guess part of what's gotten into the news in the last week or so was an emergency injunction filed by these same plaintiffs who objected to the land swap in the first place, saying that the swap was put on like a fast track, and they've been trying to sort of to like bypass the court system to get the like swap finalized before a judge could rule on the merits of the lawsuit. So that's sort of there's like the first issue of the lawsuit filed by these groups that were objecting to the land swap. And then there's this kind of subsidiary issue of like, well, it looks like they're trying to fast track the land swap like before a judge can weigh on the merits of the lawsuit. So that's the most recent thing that popped up in the news like a week ago, is that emergency injunction, because the like swap was like kind of made official in June, and that's when the lawsuit was filed. And then the emergency injunction saying, hey, wait, don't finish the swap until a judge can rule on the merits of the lawsuit, that was just filed like, yeah, just in the last week or so.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You know, Mike, this kind of paints a picture as to the balancing act that space companies and agencies are trying to balance between development and moving the needle when it comes to advancements in spaceflight, but also conservation. The way that you are explaining what Starbase wants to do down there, it's this massive operation. Is there any place to put it? Is that the issue? Is that it's so difficult to find that balance between giving space for development but also protecting nature?
Yeah, that's the age-old issue, right? That's been what people have been grappling with since the environmental movement really began, and like kind of like that the early 70s, is can we have progress and can we still protect the things that are important to us? And I mean, it's this constant push and pull between people who are on both sides of the spectrum. There's people who are on the far kind of capitalist side of things. We need to grow and we need to build and it's going to be good for everybody. And then there are people on the other side who are like, we can't do this because it will damage this land. That's the legacy that we inherited from our ancestors and we're supposed to leave to our descendants. That's the constant battle, right? And with space launch, it's pretty interesting. There are people who propose, can we launch off of offshore platforms like old oil rigs or something like that? Is that something that we could do to kind of lessen the like impact on biodiversity and on sensitive ecosystems? And that may be a route that people take in the future. But there's also another environmental kind of impact of launches and of this new space age that we're in, where we're talking about these satellite mega constellations and stuff like that. There are all these companies, the most prominent one is SpaceX, that want to put up tens of thousands of satellites, right? And we've seen that with their giant internet constellation, Starlink. There's already about 10,000 of those satellites. But then SpaceX says they want to put up 100,000 Starlinks and like a million orbiting kind of AI data centers in space. And there are other companies that want to do similar things, not necessarily on that scale. But that's another environmental issue for people who enjoy the like night sky. Will the night sky be transformed? And that's not just for sky watchers who just enjoy it, but for astronomers who use ground-based telescopes that'll have to peer through these giant mega constellations of bright, shiny satellites that are reflecting the sun as they move overhead, even in darkness. And then what's the environmental cost of launching that infrastructure to space? How many launches will it take to get a million satellites up? And to maintain that constellation at a million as each satellite lasts about 5 years and falls back to Earth. It's just, what will that do to the atmosphere? And it's not just what these like rockets are putting into the atmosphere when they launch, but what the satellites are putting into the atmosphere from their bodies as they burn up in the atmosphere. And these are all very new areas because we haven't had to deal with this stuff on this scale before. There were not satellite mega constellations until a couple of years ago when Starlink started up. So this is all new ground that we're all trying to find our way forward on. And just like every other industry, you know, it's going to have to be a give and take between people who want unfettered progress and people who want to do their best to protect what we have. So there are no answers yet. It's sort of, we're right at the beginning of this thing.
Lots to cover, and Mike Wall is there to do it. He's the channel editor for Space Flight and Tech at space.com. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure thing. It's good talking to you.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.